Welcome to the Real Vision Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Jack Farley. It is Wednesday, September 15th, joined by Darius Dale, the founder and CEO of 42 Macro. Darius, welcome.
Hey, what's up, Jack? How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. So Darius, there's really one thing that I think we have to talk about, which is China. The horror show there really shows no sign of ending. I think it's facing a three-pronged attack, which I want to talk to you about. Number one, the real estate sector is facing a $300 billion default, which could send shockwaves throughout the economy. And number two, the economy, given that or not, is itself slowing down with home prices down, retail sales rolling over, not a lot of great signals coming from that country. And then number three, the crackdowns show no sign of ending. They continue. Macau, which up until recently is thought of as something of a gambler's paradise with Wynn Resorts, Las Vegas Sands, very profitable companies there. The Chinese, the CCP put their regulatory things on hold, and the Las Vegas Sands, the Chinese version of that is down 30%. Las Vegas Sands in the U.S. is down something like 10%. So really a horror show in China. Darius, how are you making sense of this?
Yeah, I mean, look, China's an incredibly cyclical economy and an incredibly cyclical market. So, we go from these wild swings of, super accelerating growth and, boom, domestic boom that filters through the rest of the global economy to these sort of, long elongated periods where policy's tightening, growth slowing, the headlines are just persistently negative. And we're certainly in one of those periods now. From a cyclical perspective, obviously last night, overnight, we got the August hard high frequency data out of China. Retail sales slowed to 2.5%. Industrial production slowed to 5.5%. Those numbers are consistent with where they've been last summer, so like at 1-year lows. And then fixed asset investment, property investment in particular, slowed to basically where they were in December. If you look at some of the leading indicators of the Chinese economy, things that we track like the credit impulse, for instance, that peaked back in November around 32%. It's all the way down around 24.5% as of late. And so, we saw this, we've seen this coming, we're continuing to observe it. And really, there's really no end in sight over the near term with respect to the deceleration in the Chinese economic activity.
Darius, I have a question. Normally, China leads, as you say. So in 2007, when growth in China stalled and, that was a warning signal because commodity prices, economic growth, what you see in China is typically what you're going to see in the rest of the world a few months or perhaps a year later. So how do you square, what do you think that this portends for the rest of the world? Is the slowdown in Chinese growth going to be a headwind for commodity prices, for asset markets, whether it's European equities or, American equities? And also, how do you square the fact that oil and aluminum are just jumping off the charts despite this sort of crisis that we're seeing in China?
Yeah, so look, the reason commodities, oil, aluminum, things like that are jumping off the charts has a lot more to do with supply-demand imbalances in those particular markets. If you look at what's leading commodities higher, things like natural gas, uranium, those things, aluminum, those things all have, interesting fundamental stories and fundamental setups that are actually, catalyzing price appreciation there. But I'll take a step back. I think there's a big misnomer, across the investments, community of sort of isolating on China to determine the commodity exposure and sort of the outlook for commodities. And don't get me wrong, China's been a huge participant, both in absolute terms and also in marginal growth terms of consuming most commodities. So I think that's why a lot of investors anchor on it. But, the reality is there's, plenty of times in history where Chinese growth is decelerating for, several quarters before the rest of the world sort of recognizes that. I think of the most recent example was 2017. Chinese growth peaked in the first quarter of 2017, and it was slowing pretty sharply throughout the year and obviously accelerated to the downside in 2018, 2019. But you didn't really see that impact global equities until the first quarter of 2018, and obviously some of those impulses alongside the quantitative tightening that we saw really kind of hit U.S. equities in Q4 of 18 in particular.
So it's not that you don't think that the ongoing Chinese slowdown and the severe reduction in economic activity and asset prices there isn't going to affect the rest of the world. You just think that there will be a significant delay, that it's not an immediate warning signal for the rest of the world.
Yeah, exactly. And part of the reason I believe that is, you know, we're currently in this sort of Goldilocks regime from the perspective of our market regime nowcasting process. We expect Goldilocks-like market conditions to persist over the next couple of months, at least through the end of October, maybe even into the beginning part of November. But beyond that, when the net liquidity dynamics that we've been talking about in recent weeks on this program, when those start to reverse and move in the other direction, that's when you would expect the headlines that are stemming out of China, the demand impulses that are coming out of that economy to really have a material negative impact on asset markets. But for now, I think, you know, the Chinese growth curve is likely to continue lower. So by the time we get into those negative net liquidity dynamics later this year, it's actually going to be a much worse story from probably higher prices in terms of risk assets.
Darius, you talked about Goldilocks. That is an economic state of being where inflation is slowing and growth is growing at the same time. That's typically a very fertile ground for risk assets, particularly stocks. What do you see as the major threats to this Goldilocks environment that we've been in?
Yeah, so let's stick with China real quick, and then I'll broaden that out. So, you know, again, I don't necessarily believe that China will have a material impact on shaking us out of Goldilocks in the near term. However, I do believe later this year, when some of the policy dynamics in the U.S. catch up to some of the more fundamental dynamics in economies like China. But sticking with China, you know, there's five things that are really weighing on Chinese growth at the moment. One is the PBOC sort of hard-headed neutral monetary policy setting, which is obviously extremely sort of deliberate in terms of their you know, stated objectives of higher quality growth. Number two, you have President Xi's Common Prosperity Initiative and all the associated regulatory tightening. Not only is that, you know, outright weighing on growth in specific sectors, but it's actually curtailing, you know, capital investment and elsewhere in the Chinese economy. Number three, you got extended travel restrictions. You know, you got another COVID outbreak in southern provinces, so that's not helping either. Number four, you've got, you know, what has been pretty, you know, an accelerating pace of macroprudential tightening in the Chinese real estate sector. And part of the reason for that is number five, which is you have this sort of whole Evergrande debacle. You know, the looming debt default, which is likely to take place on Monday. You alluded to this, Jack. Evergrande has $300 billion U.S. in liabilities, and just under half of that is money owed to Chinese homeowners or would-be homeowners who've made down payments for, you know, sort of unfinished property. So obviously, if Evergrande defaults, it's going to be a big deal. So it's really just about the pace and the restructuring and likely the likely path forward that the Chinese authorities are comfortable with. Because obviously they're not going to let this thing turn into a Lehman situation. There's no political will, and there never will be a political will among the Chinese Communist Party for that kind of outcome.
I want to ask you about that, Darius. But before we do, let's put this chart up. You alluded to the default on Evergrande, which is expected to happen next Monday. Mm-hmm. I say about to happen because even though that Evergrande debt, as you can see on this chart, is trading at about 27 cents on the dollar, that's in green. China Evergrande is technically not in default. And as such, the CEO of Evergrande can pay out essentially who he wants, regardless of where they fall in the capital stack. But I wanted to bring up this chart because you can see that it's not just China Evergrande. There are other Chinese real estate giants, Fantasia, which is, you know, a secured bond denominated in dollars, now trading at 48 cents on the dollar. By the way, that is rated B+ by Fitch, trading at 48 cents on the dollar. Then you have Guangzhou RNF Properties, an unsecured bond rated by the Lianhe credit rating agency, Chinese, as a AAA. That now trading at $70. So let's move on to this next chart, which is essentially Chinese yield to worst of high yield credit versus the United States. I don't think this is exact apples to apples, just so you know, because it's I don't think it's entirely China, but it's vast majority of China. So the spread on high yield Chinese debt is now at 13.4%, almost as high as it was at the apex, at the worst of the pandemic. Talk about a tale of two cities. The United States high yield debt there is now yielding a meager 3.75%, not enough to keep up with current inflation. So it really is quite a stark scenario. And then lastly, let's move on to this chart, which I love. It's your chart from 42 Macro. I believe in the red is the Chinese credit impulse. Mm-hmm. Darius, you want to quickly explain what is the Chinese credit impulse and why it is such a good predictor of economic booms and slowdowns?
Yeah, so the credit impulse is an impulse metric. It's a momentum metric. And it looks at the relationship between the net change, the net nominal change in incremental credit and credit creation relative to the trailing four quarter average of GDP. And so obviously, if that change is going up, you know, there's a lot of credit creation and credit's growing faster than the economy, and it tends to precede economic accelerations and vice versa. You know, when the credit impulse is declining, it tends to precede economic decelerations. And so this chart is especially sort of helpful for investors to sort of quickly contextualize where we are with respect to Chinese leading indicators. And the reason I say that is because the blue line shows 3 month SHIBOR. SHIBOR is interbank lending rates in China. And so the reason that we show SHIBOR as a good proxy for Chinese monetary policy is because 80 plus percent, roughly around 82-83% of all private non-financial sector credit in China on the mainland is on the bank balance sheet. So that's a big deal. You know, that compares to an economy like the U.S. where, you know, we're talking about 45-47%. So it's a big deal in terms of tracking the pace of interbank rates, or the direction, rather, of interbank lending rates in China, because it'll tell you a lot about the PBOC's monetary policy setting, which takes me to my initial point, which is the fact that SHIBOR is not doing what it typically does when the Chinese credit impulse, you know, collapses like it has in recent quarters is very indicative of a very neutral monetary policy setting. They're not moving up. They're not extending medium-term lending. They're just merely rolling over existing balances. They're not doing a lot on the open market operations front. They lowered the reserve requirement ratio in June, and there might be another one, but they're not doing it in a way that would meaningfully decline or take down interbank lending rates. You typically see a 200-300 basis point decline in 3 month SHIBOR ahead of a meaningful inflection to the upside in the Chinese credit impulse. And that's very clearly what we have not observed yet.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Welcome back to the Daily Briefing. Let's get back to top analysis of today's markets. So global central banks around the world have gone hand over fist. They've done everything they possibly can to support asset markets, whether it's the Fed immediately cutting rates to zero, buying, you know, $500 billion of bonds, then, you know, at a regular clip, now it's $120 billion of bonds. ECB doing everything they possibly can. You're saying PBOC stands alone among major developed economies in not easing and really being relatively neutral. Why do you think that is? And how does it relate to your comment that you think a Lehman-like scenario of 2008 will be avoided and that the PBOC will not bail Evergrande out?
Well, I think it's just more confirmation that the Communist Party of China, led obviously by President Xi, is very serious about this sort of common prosperity initiative. And more importantly, going back to 5-6 years ago, this concept of higher quality growth. I mean, at any given time, you know, China's got $3.2 trillion of FX reserves. If they needed to bail out China Evergrande or all the banks that lend to China Evergrande, they could overnight. If they needed to build, you know, 10 more empty cities or 100 more empty cities, they very well could. The reality is that they do not want to. And that to me is a meaningful, that's a big deal in the context of, you know, sort of, you know, some of these very asymmetric commodity price charts. You know, I certainly believe commodities will do well in this Goldilocks period that we have projected for at least the next, let's call it 6 to 8 weeks. Don't hold me to that, because obviously things change. But yeah, I expect by the, you know, end of October, mid-November, we'll transition out of Goldilocks. But, you know, so I don't want to be holding the bag on these sort of asymmetric commodity price charts in the context of everything we're talking about in China, because again, this is all a leading indicator. You know, China went into the pandemic first, they emerged from the pandemic first. You go back to last year, nobody was more bullish on China than I was last year. You can fact check me on that. You know, and then they slowed first and everyone, you know, before all the other economies. It's very similar to the 2015, 2016 cycle and, you know, the 2017 to 2019 into 2020 cycle where all the economies are slowing. And actually, can I make one final point on that? You know, you go back to the dollar bond collapse or the bond collapse in the Chinese property real estate developers. Like, what is that signaling for, you know, U.S. and European real estate developers? Again, I don't think, you know, you just because there's a vulnerability doesn't mean you need to put the trade on today. I think that's the number one thing that I see a lot of investors get wrong, particularly on finance Twitter. It's just a, hey, I spotted this vulnerability and, you know, so therefore I must put the trade on. Now, that's not how investing works. You know, trades need catalysts, and the three catalysts that, you know, really move markets over time, you know, consistently, the change in growth, the change in inflation, and the change in policy dynamics.
Yeah. So I just want to be clear. You're saying that this is not at all, it's not like you're not worried about it at all. You just think that for the next 6 to 8 weeks or maybe the next few months or so, things will remain fine. What will happen once those 6 to 8 weeks happen? How do you think things will start to sort of seep out and the bull market perhaps could unwind a little bit? What are you seeing?
Yeah, so this is in terms of all the, you know, analysis that we do, it's all systematic, it's all data driven. This is probably the least systematic and data driven aspect of our analysis because, you know, it's anchoring on my expectations for how the fiscal policy dynamics are likely to evolve in DC. And there's really, you know, obviously, in any given time, we can have a ton of confidence in that or not much confidence in that. I think you'd be lying to yourself if you ever got too confident. But the reality is, you know, so we have the debt ceiling thing. You know, Yellen is obviously taking down the Treasury general account balance, which is a positive from a liquidity percent perspective. You know, there's about roughly, you know, a little bit more or less than $200 billion to go in terms of that that base. And obviously, the Fed is still buying $120 billion a month, $80 billion Treasuries, $40 billion mortgage-backed securities. So, you know, as long as we're doing those two things, you're talking about incremental net liquidity to the market at a time where we don't see, at least our models are, you know, bottom-up macro regime forecasting tools don't anticipate a meaningful slowdown in either growth or inflation, which would be more negative from the perspective of the market response. And so we have this sort of, you know, in the context of everything I just said, you can kind of sort of block out all the noise on China, block out all the noise on the size of the budget, the next stimulus package and all that stuff, and just say, hey, no, look, investors are positioned very cautiously, and we can unpack that if you like. The economy's not doing anything that should scare you if you look at the chart Jack has up. Obviously, all the dots are clustered near the origin. And oh, by the way, when you're clustered near the origin, it puts the onus on policy. And what I just said about net liquidity is quite positive. But to answer your question, what do we see coming in the end of the year that is a lot different? Well, you have the confluence of two very different dynamics that we have now. You have tapering. The Fed is going to start to capitalize the U.S. government at a slower rate. At the same time, we're likely to go from issuing very little debt to no debt in the context of the debt ceiling and a potential lack of a continuing resolution to issuing a ton of debt, like hundreds of billions of dollars at some point in, you know, mid to late November and December. Like, to me, I think that switch is going to be very negative from the perspective of risk assets, because this we know. Foreign central banks aren't gobbling up our debt like they used to, you know, in the early part of the or in the pre-crisis era. That's a problem. The Fed is obviously going to take down their uptake. And then so that means us investors, remember that our conversation about the schoolyard bully last week, we have to capitalize all that treasury supply. So that to me is, I think, the real big catalyst coming down the pike that I really don't hear a lot of investors talking about.
Yeah, Darius, we still have this chart up. And if people can see very close to the origin point where the X and the Y axis meet, you'll see all these different points. And we really are circling around, hovering between Goldilocks and deflation. And Darius, something that you cleared up for me on a call we had earlier this afternoon was that something can be very mildly in Goldilocks and therefore have a very mildly predictive power for a very mild equity market rally or rally in risk assets. And that could be very close to a very mild deflationary reading. So there are levels to these things, and it's not just like, oh, this is Goldilocks, so things are going to do well. This is deflation and things are going to do well or do poorly, I should say.
Yeah, absolutely. So like, and to put some numbers on what you just said. Yeah. So when you're only slowing modestly from the perspective of growth, from the perspective of the economy, the Y axis, and you're in deflation, you're in that bottom left box, it's actually historically been quite positive. If you look at 25 years of monthly returns, you know, for something like the S&P 500, the annualized expected return there is 11% plus 11%. However, when you go to the bottom left, you know, when growth's slowing, you know, quite precipitously, that's when the annualized expected return goes from, you know, modest slowdown at plus 11% annualized to minus 25% annualized. Like, that's a big difference. So the speed of the change really matters, which is why that we present the information this way, because you can obviously easily visualize it.
Yeah, Darius, before we move on to commodities, there are like four questions about Evergrande's impact on foreign markets. So Jeff Defoe wants to know, what's the chance of this bleeding over to the general U.S. market? Lisa wants to know, how likely is the spread of an Evergrande default to bonds held outside China? And Show Me the Money wants to know, in other words, is this a Lehman moment for global markets?
No, it's not. Actually, I don't want to say no, it's not without any range of probable outcomes. But I think the modal outcome of whatever that distribution is very much on the side of the right side of the distribution. And the reason I say that is because China, again, has $3.2 trillion of FX reserves that they can just dump at this problem if it became a real problem, right? Like, that's a lot of money. Like, we need to acknowledge that. Now, that might mean they need to sell some, treasury bills or something to capitalize that outcome, but they certainly can get that done if they needed to. And the reality is again, the Chinese banks aren't levered, and more importantly, they're not capitalizing themselves with toxic assets like what we saw in the GFC. And I think this is another stake investors make a decent amount, which is they're always like looking in the rearview mirror at the previous crisis. Like, oh, it's Evergrande, it's a debt default. This reminds me of Lehman, or this reminds me of Bear Stearns. And no, the next crisis will be something completely different, just like this most recent one was a pandemic. It won't be a pandemic. It'll be something else. And that's kind of why you have to build systematic, repeatable processes that are data driven, that allow you to dial up or dial down your risk at important intervals in and around things changing, because it's always going to change.
Darius, when you went like this, be honest, is the reason you did that just because you're so proud of your background, which looks so cool?
Yeah, no, I finally got my whatever that thing is called. Oh, I learned this. I grew up very poor, so I'm learning all these words as I advance in my adult life. That's called a credenza. I got that at Restoration Wayfair, where you guys like to shop at the high-end places. Restoration Wayfair.
Credenza, yeah. It's basically like a table?
I guess a table with cabinets. That's my definition of a credenza, the table with cabinets.
But checks anyway, out. So. Darius, let's move on to commodities. Earlier, you said that the next 6 to 8 weeks, you expect to be bullish for commodities because of these liquidity dynamics. What are you seeing when you zoom in a little bit, whether it's at aluminum or uranium or oil? What are you seeing in those markets?
Yeah, so the number one thing I'm seeing in commodities is the fact that the leadership is occurring in places where there's clear supply-demand imbalances, like uranium, like nat gas, like base metals, aluminum, iron ore, stuff like that. You're seeing a very much of a laggardship with respect to ag commodities. I think the supply demand imbalances kind of came and went there with respect to hurricane season. And actually, the DBA as a proxy for ag is actually down 3% month on month, whereas the DBB, which is the base metals, is actually up 4%. So you're seeing some dispersion in commodities. You're actually seeing commodities actually outperform all the other major asset classes. If you look at the DBC, and these are month on month returns through 3:30 p.m. today. DBC is up 3.9%. TLT is second at up 1.3%. Bitcoin and gold are tied for third at up 0.8%. SPY is up only 0.5%. And dollars flat to down. What does all that sound like? It kind of sounds like Goldilocks, right?
Was this today, Darius?
No, yeah, these are month-on-month returns. So
month-on-month returns, okay. Okay, thanks for that. Yeah, I should say, Darius, I think WTI crude oil is up $2 today. The U.S. energy sector XLE was up a lot. I think EOG, if you looked at the stocks that were most up in the S&P 500, it was like a who's who of all these. It was like EOG, FANG, ExxonMobil. So definitely a huge, that was definitely the bull market rip out today. Mm-hmm. Darius, tell us about how you not only use the macro cycle to predict commodity prices, but use commodity prices to predict the macro cycle as well.
Yeah, so that's a loaded question. So at 42 Macro, we're constantly bean counting and measuring, mapping two aspects that I think are really important for investors. One, what is the top-down market regime? We're always now casting what's the general behavior of asset markets on a trending basis. And right now, that general behavior has been Goldilocks, and it's been generally Goldilocks since the beginning of June. And then we're also trying to forecast, measure, map, and forecast the bottom-up macro regime cycle. So top-down market regime, bottom-up macro regime. And what I mean by the bottom up macro regime is exactly what was, what's depicted in these grid charts. You know, what regime is the economy actually going to be at in various intervals in the future? Because that should, at the bare minimum, instruct our expectations for how the market regime, the market behavior is likely to change. To me, the sequence, the change in the market regime is how you make or lose a lot of money as an investor. So that's why, you know, we try to keep our investors, people who subscribe to 42 Macro, very aware of these changing dynamics.
We're going to take another quick break, but we'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to the Daily Briefing. Let's get back to top analysis of today's markets. Yeah, I know a lot of people look at something like the copper to gold ratio, where if that's high, a lot of people want to buy copper because economic activity is robust. If it's low, it's because a lot of people want the safety of gold. Darius, there's also the lumber to gold ratio, which is something that our friend Michael Guyad has his eye on. Darius, I'm pleased to say that you actually did your first Real Vision interview in the host seat, where you talked to Michael about his process. Here, we're going to play a clip about him explaining why the lumber to gold ratio is important. Let's take a look, and then I want to get your thoughts on it.
Why would lumber gold have anything to do with the stock market? It becomes very clear when you think about the link to housing. Right? So we know that lumber is a leading indicator of the economy. Housing is a leading indicator of the economy. Most people's wealth is in their homes. The average home has about 16,000 board feet of lumber. So it stands to reason that if housing is a leading indicator, well, then lumber, by extension, because of the long tail construction, must be a leading indicator as well. So as lumber performs, there's all kinds of implications on what it suggests for growth, inflation, credit creation, so on and so forth. Now, gold, on the other hand, is more of a safe haven commodity historically, meaning that when you have these high risk periods in the stock market, these tails wagging, gold for a moment in time tends to do fairly well. So if you compare lumber to gold, it actually tells you a lot about risk. Now, one of the key data points in that paper is if over the last rolling 13 weeks, which is the look back period for the lumber to gold relationship in that research, if lumber is outperforming gold over the last 13 weeks, the S&P 500's volatility on average is around 12.5%. If gold is outperforming lumber over the last 13 weeks, the go-forward volatility on the S&P rises quite a bit to an average of 17%.
So, Darius, what do you make of Michael's thinking that the lumber-to-gold ratio can be a predictive outcome for the economy and asset prices, not only giving you an extra return, but also a significant protection against market volatility? I know you look at so many different indicators. Just tell us about that sort of process.
Yeah, so I think so for starters, let me say that was a phenomenal interview. If you want to learn stuff about how to do buy-side level risk management, I definitely think you should check that out next week. Obviously we had some actionable thoughts in there, but I really do think that's a masterclass in how to actually use cyclical information to orient your risk management, which I think a lot of investors, we could all get better at, including myself. But going back to the lumber to gold ratio, what I think Michael is actually sort of empirically observing in his process is the fact that the rate of change of growth in particular is one of the principal components of asset class returns. And so he highlighted that, look, okay, when the lumber to gold ratio is positive on a performance basis, on a relative performance basis, you know, you typically have S&P 500 volatility in the kind of 12% range. And when that's negative, i.e. it's implying that growth is slowing because gold tends to be a deflate or a risk off asset, whereas lumber tends to be a risk on asset. You have S&P 500 volatility in the sort of 12 to 18% range. Ironically or not ironically, that's exactly what our findings suggest as well. So if you go back to the grid chart, when you're above the horizontal axis, as the, you know, what it means, you know, growth's accelerating, the mean volatility for the S&P 500 is actually 12.5%. And when you're below the horizontal axis, i.e. growth is decelerating, the mean volatility for the S&P 500 is 17.5%. This is our empirical finding as well. So two separate processes, but one thing, the number one thing they have in common is they're measuring and mapping cycles, and you know, cycles that are really important with respect to asset markets.
Yeah, it's interesting how two people's frameworks, they can appear slightly different, but they have the base assumption that what's happening in the real economy is going to impact asset markets and the vice versa. Interestingly, what I found, this is the lumber to gold ratio, the 13-week rate of change, which I believe is what Michael uses. It's at something like a 20-year low. I didn't even look back further. So that's a little ominous. Let's put that chart down. Darius, I want to ask you, you know, we were going to talk about inflation, but it just popped in my head. You know, I consume a little bit of financial media. I watch, you know, some of the other networks. I'm seeing bull market equity investors beg for a pullback. I'm seeing a lot of that because over the past 10 months, we haven't even had a 5% correction, which is close to unprecedented, very rare. And then likewise, I saw in the Bloomberg editorial page, not an op-ed, but from the editorial board, they were saying, hey, the Federal Reserve, you should taper. So isn't there kind of, it's kind of like things are so good right now that even investors are like, it needs to stop. It's like, it's too good. To what degree? I know you're a very quantitative
preposterous. That sounds like people who aren't making money in the stock market. Like, quite frankly, you know, not to be too harsh to that community of investors, but again, this is every time. I mean, been coming on this program for months and saying the same thing. Look, people are caught at the bare minimum. They're cautiously positioned, and in and around these OPEX catalysts that we've seen since June, July, and August, and now they get very defensively positioned. The mean implied volatility premium, which is the relationship between a 30-day at-the-money put implied vol in terms of how we calculate it, relative to the regime of local realized volatility, 10-day, 20-day, 30-day realized volatility, is 58%. Like, they're paying 58% more for puts than what's just happened in the recent past. Like, that, like, to me, you've seen this dynamic occur all summer, whereas people just are looking around, they see Fed taper, they see China slowing. You know, they think the fiscal catalyst, the fiscal policy thing is going to be a mess, you know, over the next, you know, month or two. And they're just so bearish, at least, you know, cautiously positioning with respect to the outright positioning, with respect to their hedging activity, their delta hedging activity, and ultimately with respect to their asset allocation in terms of the sectors and style factors that they've consistently flowed assets into since inflation peaked back in early June.
Darius, as we reach a close, two questions for you. Number one, can you give us your quick take on yesterday's inflation print, which came in 5.3% exactly at what was expected? But I think if you remove food and energy, it was lower than expected. So some people are saying inflation has proved to be transitory. Your thoughts on that? And then a viewer wants to know what you think of Japan.
Yeah. So I'll start with inflation. So it was incrementally confirming of our long-held transitory view. We've always been in the transitory camp. You know, part of the reason for us being in the transitory camp is because, you know, we were, you know, I guess not dumb enough to not realize, yeah, that two negatives, yeah, not dumb enough to not realize that the record fiscal impulse we saw in the first half of the year was transitory. Reopening, the impulse there associated with that was transitory. And obviously the deflationary base effects of the spring of last year are also transitory. Therefore, the 5% headline CPI, the 4% core CPI, and the 3% plus core PCE data points were likely to be transitory. That doesn't mean they're coming straight down in any time soon. They're likely to remain sticky if for other, you know, reasons like shelter CPI is still accelerating. But the reality is it's transitory, and that's what we saw with some of the data. You know, a couple of things to call out in particular, you know, core goods CPI, which is where all the supply chain disruptions are occurring, actually slowed 80 basis points to 7.7%. year over year. That's a 3-month low, but that 80 basis point deceleration was the sharpest deceleration we've seen since June of 1983. I wasn't even born in 1983, so that's a long time ago. The annualized rate of core CPI has been cut by 90% since April. Now it's only at 1.2%. So, you know, I think that was a big question for a lot of investors, particularly, you know, you go back to that that April CPI report, which was released on May 12th. That was kind of like the bell ringer. That's when it shot up above 4%, remember? And that's when everyone started going, oh my God, inflation. And we've been doing, oh my God, inflation ever since. But the reality is, ever since that day, bonds are outperforming stocks, commodities, and crypto on a total return basis since then. So, oh my God, inflation missed the point about the inflation cycle peaking and rolling right when our model suggested they would.
Final question about Japan. Yeah, Vladis says, how does Darius feel about Japan? Let's take it the equity market.
Yeah, so we'll start with the equity market on Japan a couple weeks ago. Fact check me on that. I want to say a couple weeks ago, broke out to bullish from the perspective of our volatility adjusted momentum signal. It had been neutral for a while. So whatever, the dynamics that were causing Japan to slow or to contract in the equity market terms actually got resolved to the upside. And so to me, I think that might be a stealth leading indicator alongside the outperformance of commodities in the last month as, okay, the world is actually starting to move past Delta, right? Like it's been Delta since, the beginning of August, middle of July. And now I think the world is starting to send signals that Delta's increasingly in the rearview mirror. And then another thing that happened last week is the 10-year Japanese government bond yield, which is one of the 42 macro market indicators featured in our global macro risk matrix, which is the tool we use to now cast the market regime. That went to neutral from bearish. And so this follows the 10-year gilt yield and the 10-year TIPS break even from breaking out from bearish to neutral from the perspective of that BAM signal. So to me, I think you're starting to kind of add up things that are moving at the margin that say, hey, maybe the world's moving past Delta. And if that's the case, I think it'll likely be driven by a bounce in the September data. Could potentially see a bounce in the October data if September, if particularly in the U.S. if Delta has not moved quickly enough. But again, I think that all sort of favors Goldilocks at least over the next couple of months. And more importantly, I think that favors more broadening participation in the equity market. I don't think it's appropriate to run out and lever up long, cyclical stocks at this point in the juncture, because again, we know that we're going to have to sell that stuff, within the next couple of months in terms of the net liquidity dynamics being unfavorable. And ultimately, you don't necessarily want to be wearing a lot of liquidity risk at that juncture. But for those of you who are, retail investors, RIA investors that aren't moving a ton of capital, I certainly think there are opportunities there as well.
Darius, it's always great to have you on the Daily Briefing. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you to everyone for watching as well. We've got some great interviews lined up, on Real Vision. In addition to Darius's interview with Michael Guide, which I believe airs next Tuesday, tomorrow Rao will be speaking to a venture capitalist. It's an exponential age piece on space travel. I know Rao is extremely excited about it. And then on Friday, Rao is speaking to legendary macro insider James Aitken. I believe they talk about everything macro, it's inflation. So I definitely have my eyes peeled on that one. Darius, thank you again for coming. It's always a pleasure. And thank you everyone for watching.
Yeah, thank you guys. Thanks, Jack. Catch you guys here next time.